You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Her Money is proudly sponsored by Edelman Financial Engines. When prices are soaring, it's more important than ever to check in with your investments and make sure your money is working for you. Discuss strategies for tackling all of life's rising costs with a complimentary wealth checkup. Schedule yours today at planefe.com/hermoney or by calling 833-304. P-L-A-N.
Hey, it's Motley Fool Money co-host Dylan Lewis here. If you're listening to us, it's because you love following the stock market and learning about business stories. If you're looking to keep learning and unlock your potential, then you should check out the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast produced by our friends over at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the Webby Award-winning Best Business Podcast that's received nearly 43 million downloads and is the number one career podcast in 95-plus countries, so you know it's worth your time. Each week, host and Stanford lecturer Matt Abraham sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to hone and develop your communication skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, to keeping your nerves in check while speaking, to being more persuasive. Whether you're working on your elevator pitch or planning an important meeting, strong communication skills are important in business and life in general. That's why you'll hear from pros like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, as well as speechwriter, best-selling author, and friend of the Fool, Dan Pink, on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more available on the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast. So what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
Hey everyone, it's Jean Chatsky. Thanks so much for joining me today on Her Money. Today's show is a conversation with Betsy Stevenson. She's an economist who weighs in on why women are both sadder in our day-to-day lives than men, but happier overall, and what the economy has to do with all of that. But before we jump into that interview with Betsy, let's get into some news. On Monday, Tesla announced it will be laying off 10% of its workforce as competition continues to surge and demand to wane in the electric vehicle space. In a memo obtained by CNBC, Musk said that the company needs to make cost reductions and increase productivity as it prepares for its next phase of growth. Tesla's stock is down about 30% year to date, and as I record this, continuing to fall, and the company has faced logistical problems this year as well as lower sales in places like China, where competition is the highest. These layoffs are part of an ongoing stretch of tech companies laying off staff this year, even as technology-related company earnings are leading the S&P 500. Bloomberg recently reported that Tesla's terrible year means it's no longer part of the group of tech stocks known as the Magnificent Seven. The Wall Street Journal recently reported that the number of Gen Z students attending vocational training programs in community colleges has surged 16% as higher tuition costs have caused enrollment at colleges across the country to dip. More and more, we're seeing young people pursuing welding, plumbing, and electrician careers where they can graduate in 9-ish months. Many expect to make 6 figures within 5 years. This shift goes hand in hand with younger generations' disenchantment with office work. Many don't want to spend all their time in front of a computer. These careers give them the freedom to get out in the world, spend their days using their hands, and interacting with people. It's pretty good timing as well. The cost of labor is on the rise as older electricians and plumbers and welders retire. For example, according to data from ADP, new construction hires can expect to make about $48,000 a year. By contrast, new hires in professional services are earning about $40,000 a year. And yes, that is $8,000 less. And now we're going to take a quick break.
Her Money is proudly sponsored by Edelman Financial Engines. With the cost of everything on the rise, including healthcare, housing, college educations, and so much more, It's time to check in with your investments and make sure your money is working just as hard as you do. Because the best way to help make sure your money's there for you in retirement and whenever you need it most is to have a strategy for tackling all of life's rising costs. Visit planefe.com/hermoney to schedule your complimentary wealth checkup today. We are back with my interview with Betsy Stevenson. So I was fascinated by a recent essay in the Wall Street Journal by Emily Beaubrow that makes the case that women are both happier overall, but sadder in our daily lives than men as we juggle the competing priorities on our never-ending to-do lists, from managing our jobs to our kids' schedules to keeping up with cooking if we cook and housework if we do that. Emily also acknowledges that, like almost all of her friends, and this is what she says, she's on antidepressants, and for the most part, she is also happy. Data from the CDC backs this up. They recently reported that more women than ever before are on antidepressants, and the number is highest for women who are, quote unquote, middle-aged. So what's this all about? Is this the burden of being primary caregivers who are also working full time? Or does it have to do with economic factors outside of our control? Or is it a little bit of everything? Betsy Stevenson is an economist and professor at the University of Michigan, formerly chief economist of the United States Department of Labor. She has conducted groundbreaking research into a lot of this. She spent years digging into why women's happiness has been on the decline, despite the fact that it seems like we have made some strides for women's equality, despite the occasional setback. And while we have her, we're also going to do a mini economic check-in now that we're 4 months, can you believe it, into 2024. Betsy, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
It's great to chat with you today about these issues, both the economy and women's well-being.
So let me just acknowledge that I am a fan. I'm a fan of both your work, but I'm also a later in life fan of economics, despite the fact that I got a C in it in college to my chagrin. It was the first C I'd ever gotten in my life. I was actually horrified. But one of the things that fascinates me about economics and economists is that you can pretty much study anything. There is always an economic tie. You're a labor economist. What made you go down that road?
I love that you started here because I think it actually, the whole thing really connects together. Economics is a study of really how people make decisions given all the constraints they face in the world, right? So a lot of people think, oh, economics has something to do with money. It doesn't. Actually, money is just a measuring tool, right? It's like saying architecture has to do with rulers. Of course, you might use a ruler if you're an architect, but you wouldn't define your field as being about rulers. You would define your field, right, in much bigger terms, in terms of what you're designing and doing. And when we study economics, what we're studying is how do people handle trade-offs? Everything you do has a cost. That cost might not be money, a money cost, but it is what economists call an opportunity cost, because every single thing you do, there's something else you could be doing instead. You know, and that something else you're doing could be doing instead, it probably has some value. And so when you think about how costly anything you're doing is, the easy way to do it is to say, well, also, what would I be doing instead? And how much value does that have? And boy, does that tie in to thinking about women's lives, because women are always juggling so many things and they're always having to make these constant trade-offs in the moment of, should I stay at work and try to catch up on a project so I can get ahead? Or do I need to get home and help my kid with their homework because they're not going to get it done if I'm not there? How do I think about this trade-off? How do I think about a trade-off where some of the benefits are to me on one of the items, and the other thing, the benefits are to my family, right? And so these things are very complicated. that's sort of the idea of economics. You asked about labor in particular, and that's because my interest was how people make decisions about how to spend their productive time. And I felt like, you know, one of the things that was missing was men who study labor economics would just ignore what was happening at home and say, well, let's just think about how you decide whether to be a nurse or an economist or a teacher. And I was like, or a stay-at-home mom, or if I become a teacher, how does that impact my ability to spend time with my kids? Or if I become an investment banker, how does that affect my ability to spend time with my kids? Those decisions are very tied. And that's where a lot of my interest has been. You said that you got a C in economics and you're just coming back to it. And I think that this ties both topics you wanted to talk about, I think, together really well, which I think women are socialized to be more interested in the interconnections in people's lives. I think economics is deeply about that. But I think that a lot of the men who are teaching economics, perhaps whoever taught you economics, somehow forgot to tell you about all these rich people's lives that were behind maybe the graphs they were drawing, the concepts they were teaching. In fact, some economists just washed over the people so much that when they would talk about businesses, they'd refer to something like a widget, which is a nonsense word.
Yes.
Right. And like, how are you supposed to relate when you're talking about nonsense things? There are real people's lives that we could talk about. That's interesting. And I think when we get that into the economics, people of all genders can come more alive to the subject.
As you have looked at women over the last couple of decades, what is it that you think is contributing to this distressing increase in sadness? I read some research that you did with your colleague Justin Wolfers, and you talked about the lower standards theory. Is that it? And if it is, can you explain it? And if not, what is this about?
So I want to just start by saying we don't know what exactly is going on. So what our research showed was that women were becoming less happy relative to men, and that this was narrowing what had been a happiness gap in which women had said that they were happier than men. One of the things that I looked at was dimensions of happiness. And what I saw was that if you look in the data, marital happiness and women's overall happiness used to be more correlated. In other words, if I knew your marital happiness in 1960, I could do a much better job of predicting how happy you would say you were overall than I can today. And it's hard for us to measure these sort of changes over time because they're capturing something different because our expectations about our lives have changed. So when we look at this data, I think it's really important for social scientists to have a degree of humility in terms of what we can and can't say. And so that's the first thing. We know that the trend showed women becoming less happy. That was what I documented. I think in subsequent years, that trend has flatlined so that we haven't seen women getting less happy relative to men in research other people have done over the last decade. There's still this sort of open question about whether life satisfaction is doing a good job of capturing day-to-day well-being and overall mental health. And we've always known that they're not necessarily the same thing. In fact, life satisfaction is very correlated with things that make a good life. And that makes sense, right? So if you have more income, you tend to have higher life satisfaction. If you're married, you tend to have higher life satisfaction. If you have a lot of friends, you tend to have higher life satisfaction. So the question is, this evaluative stepping back and looking at your life, we know sort of that that's predicted by the kinds of things that most people want in their life. And we know that women's life satisfaction has remained quite high. There's this other question, which is, and this is what I thought was really interesting about the essay you read, is she was trying to draw out, is it possible for our life satisfaction to be high while day to day we're struggling with issues related to our mental health and our affect? And I think the answer is, of course, these things could be simultaneously happening.
As we look to sort of puzzle it together, and the way when you talk about the day-to-day research versus sort of the overall research, I'm reminded of the research on money and happiness, because there's been that sort of a take as well, that the short-term picture may be slightly different than the long-term picture. But if we're trying to solve for the fact that women are a little more stressed, anxious, depressed, pick your word, day-to-day, in the moment, how can the tools of economics help us do that better?
Before I answer that, let me step back for a minute, because I have been very deep in that research on overall income and happiness and well-being. And so I think it's really important for people to realize that the data is unambiguously clear that more income leads to higher life satisfaction and higher well-being in a lot of different ways. But there are a couple of things that you want to understand. One is that relationship between income and well-being is between the log of income and well-being. Okay, that sounds technical. Why do I bother to say the log? It's about percentage changes in the income. So it means that if I get a 5% increase in my income, I'm going to get the same amount of increase in my overall life satisfaction, no matter how much income I have. But to get a 5% boost, if I'm somebody making $20,000 a year, that involves a lot less money than if I'm somebody making $2 million a year, right? So it is that relationship being between the log or percentages means that each dollar that you get gives you less bang for your joy buck as you get more and more dollars. And I think sometimes that gets confused and has led people to mistakenly think that after you get a certain amount of money, you no longer get gains in well-being. You do. It just takes more and more and more money to get the same gain in well-being. Sometimes I'd present my research on this and people would say, oh, okay, so I should take the job that's going to pay the most. And I'm like, no, 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 no. That's not what the research is saying. It's a correlation. And that correlation is also correlated with other things. So I show in my research that if you have more income, you're also more likely to report that people treat you with respect. Now, that could be because people treat people with more income respectfully, but I also like to think of it as if you have more income, you have more ability to remove yourself from situations in which people are treating you poorly. If you are a low-income person, you need your job to survive, and your boss or your coworker is treating you terribly, you just may have to continue to sustain that terrible relationship. The more income you have, the easier it is for you to say, you know what, I'm going to quit this and look for something else. And in fact, we also see that in the data that shows the more income you have, the more likely you are to say you have control over the choices you're making in your life, or you have control over your daily life, or you have control. And I think when we think about what matters for people's well-being, it's really the same things that matters for a kid to have a great day in kindergarten. Okay, you need people to treat you with respect. You need to have some control over how you spend your time. You need to be able to learn something interesting. You need to be able to do something creative. You need to eat good tasting food. Seriously, like those are the things that give people a good life. They also give you a great day in kindergarten. And that's because they are the fundamental building blocks of what people need. And what we see is the more income you have, the more you can get access to those things. What economics tells us is that it's not like income falling out of trees. It's also that income's correlated with our ability to earn higher income. So I always like to give the example of my very best friend from college in the world chose to go off and become a legal aid attorney. She and I went to college together. Sometimes she got better grades than me. We both went to graduate school. Like, she has the same earnings capabilities that I have. I don't think that if she earns less, it's going to predict that she would be less happy. She's actually using her earnings capabilities to do something that's generating a lot of good in the world. And that makes her feel, you know, good and satisfied with how she's spending her life. So I think people can make that choice. But what we see is that on average, the more people can earn, the more their group of people do earn on average, right? So what I wish we could measure was not your actual earnings, but your earnings capabilities, given all of the things that are at your disposal, your education and your training and your interests and your financial situation and your ability to make investments and all of these things that determine what your earnings capability could be. Because I think at the end of the day, the relationship between income and well-being is a relationship between potential income and well-being.
When it comes to retirement, women want different things. We want safety, security, stability, and the ability to live life on our own terms. One way we can achieve all of that is with an annuity. If you're not familiar with annuities, the concept is that essentially you take a chunk of money and turn it into a paycheck that you can start drawing on when you want to, next year or next decade. The ParityFlex multi-year guaranteed annuity available from Gainbridge offers security and flexibility at a time when women need it most, retirement. A guaranteed lifetime withdrawal benefit means you'll have a consistent income even when your account balance is zero. Plus, you'll get guaranteed returns at 5.95% APY. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for important information. This is a paid endorsement. Hey, everybody, it's Jean. If you want to continue unlocking your potential, then you should also check out Think Fast, Talk Smart, produced by our friends at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the Webby Award-winning best business podcast that received nearly 50 million downloads. It's the number one career podcast in 95 countries, so you know it's worth your time. Each week, host and Stanford lecturer Matt Abraham sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to hone and develop your communication skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression to keeping your nerves in check while speaking to being more persuasive. Whether you're working on your elevator pitch or planning an important meeting, strong communication skills are critical to business. All that and so much more is available on Think Fast, Talk Smart. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. To bring it back to women for a second and how women are feeling in this moment where the gender wage gap hasn't really budged that much and the caregiving responsibilities, as the pandemic showed us, were still very likely to fall in our lap. And when we look at things like housework, we see that even when a woman is the primary breadwinner, she's likely to go home and do more of it than the guy in the house. What do you suggest in order to improve life satisfaction in this scenario that hasn't really changed for many, many years?
Well, I think what the data shows is it's life satisfaction's okay, but we've got to work on our day-to-day happiness. We got to take more time, prioritize more time for mental health, for well-being. And that might mean that, you know, we sacrifice achievements or career goals or the things that I just said are correlated with life satisfaction and focus more on day-to-day well-being. I really believe that the great tragedy of the Barbie movie not being nominated, the director not being nominated for an Oscar for directing, is that that movie is one of the best social commentaries I've seen in a really long time. And because what it showed was the dissatisfaction of Barbie and the women who seemed to have it all on paper, but yet were missing like an emotional depth, that she deeply wanted that emotional depth, even with all the messiness that it came with. And that the problem in the real world was her female counterpart in the real world, no matter what you do, always felt like still coming up short and yet constantly striving. If I just do a little bit more, maybe finally I will feel like I'm getting my full credit. And I think almost every woman out there has had that moment of just like, it's never enough. I've done so much and I keep going. And yet there's this nitpicking, this sense of, well, if you just do a little bit more, maybe you'll finally get your goal. Maybe we'll finally give you equality. Maybe we'll finally treat you the same way. And I think there's just this exhaustion that comes from thinking that we are just going to be strivers and we're going to persevere our way out of gender inequality. And I think that is absolutely exhausting. And I want to say the flip side of that movie, what I loved so much about the Barbie movie was that it also showed the Kens are just lost. The men are lost because they don't know what to do.
Yeah, you wrote a great piece about it. The working men, too, who are in their own throes of a crisis, can learn a lot from what happened in that movie. And the America Ferrera speech, by the way, totally made me cry because I could relate. It made me cry both times.
I think that speech for, particularly for women of a certain age, right? Because I remember talking to my 13-year-old niece who was like, I don't get it. I was like, I'm so glad and I hope you never knew. But if you've been out there just striving since you were 13 and trying to figure out, like, what do I need to do? What more can I do? It was a speech that made you cry. It made me cry. I love the fact that she didn't leave out the fact that men are in their own crisis. And theirs is a crisis of having fallen off a pedestal that they can still see the pedestal, but it's gotten harder and harder to get back on it. So there's all these, we still see a patriarchy that delivers unfair benefits to men. But most men are like, where are my benefits? I'm not seeing them. And that was like what was going on with Ken. Ken's like, I'm trying. I see the patriarchy and they won't let me in. And why won't they let him in? That they won't let him in because he doesn't have the skills necessary to be an elite man in this society. So that patriarchy has sort of coalesced around a very small elite group of men and has abandoned all sorts of other men and given them their own crisis. I think that it would be good for the mental health of men and women if they could come together. But we've seen this problem in the data. So we can move from talking about movies to talking about facts. We got men who don't find work, but won't do childcare. Men who are not ready to move on from being supported by their moms. And when they show up at their girlfriends, are not prepared to do the fair share of household and child work. And yet they're not trained and able in this labor market to be like a breadwinner who supports an entire household. Women have been going to college more than men for the last 30 years. So a lot of men who have finished high school but not gone on for more education have very low earnings abilities, and they're in a dating market with women with maybe a 2-year community college nursing degree who have very stable jobs, are in demand, who are bringing home a very solid income. And it's not surprising that there's a lot of tension in those relationships. And you know, we've been looking at whether there would be like a marriage romantic crisis really for the last 20 years, because when you look at the data, you know, you worry about a world in which women are going to college and men aren't, where women are moving into in-demand jobs and men aren't, where the economy is really the global economy, the demand of the world has shifted towards services because we can make things in really automated factories, but we can't care for people in automated factories. And so an increasing share of the jobs become caregiving, and men are terrified that they're sacrificing their masculinity if they go into something like preschool. But I have to tell you, I'm so grateful for every male teacher my son has had. And if I could put a plea out there to men, please go into teaching preschool, to teaching elementary school, to teaching middle school, to teaching high school, because I think the mental health crisis our children are having would be helped if we had diverse classrooms with men being as likely as women in all of the grades and levels of education.
Yeah, I remember I didn't have very many male teachers until I got to college, but I remember them all really fondly. I think that you're right. We only have a few minutes left, and I want to ask you about the economy because, boy, you know, it feels like we are on a bit of a roller coaster. The Fed seems to not want to make up its mind about what it's going to do. The indicators are inflation is higher than it was anticipated it would be right now. Unemployment is lower than it was anticipated that it would be, although there's some noise, I think, in those numbers. And we've got a big election coming up on which many people believe that the economy will continue to be the issue that people vote. So where do you think we are?
Well, first of all, you just pointed out how hard it is to forecast, and particularly when you're in a changing economy. If you had asked economists to bet 10 years ago on what unemployment would be today, very few people would have bet it would be as low. And that's even before seeing a pandemic coming. If you had asked economists in the beginning of 2020, what's the chance that the unemployment rate's below 4% in just a few years? Very few people would have said yes. And that's because I was literally trained on the idea that the economy cannot sustain unemployment much below 5%. That unemployment below 5% is just, it sparks inflation because employers get antsy. They can't find the workers they need. They start paying them more, and then they raise the prices to their customers. And the next thing you know, we've got what's called a wage price spiral. Inflation is off to the races. So, you know, why can we have unemployment as low as we have it? Well, there's a couple reasons. One is that it's easier to find jobs now, so people search electronically, and it's a different process. So we don't need to spend a dedicated period unemployed. We've seen a lot of people move from job to job, and a lot of people wake up one day and think it's time to go back to work. They start searching online, and they find a job so quickly they never get counted as the unemployed. So we didn't used to have people move from out of the labor market to into the labor market as quickly as we do now. And that sort of explains why unemployment can be so low. But at the end of the day, unemployment's low because people are getting a lot of jobs. And they're getting a lot of jobs because the economy is expanding. The economy is expanding much faster than anyone expected. A big reason the economy is expanding is because people are starting new businesses, and they open a new business and they go to hire and they can find people to hire. And the reason they can find people to hire is because immigration has picked up in the last year and a half. And as controversial as that immigration topic is, I have to tell you, if we hadn't had the immigrants coming in and over the last year and a half, something would have had to give. We wouldn't have been able to expand as quickly because there's just not, it's not like there's a bunch of Americans who are at home thinking, I'll enter the labor market as soon as there's fewer immigrants around. They're just not entering the labor market for a whole host of complicated reasons. And we see that among people in the sort of prime of life, that sort of 30s and 40s, labor force participation, particularly among women, it's at an all-time high. So we're getting the native-born people into the labor market sort of as much as we possibly can, and we're bringing in immigrants to fill in the gaps, and that's allowing us to expand. Inflation rose around the globe for one simple reason. Our demand for goods and services recovered faster than our desire to go back to work and our factories and our production of stuff could recover. And that happened across the globe. Everybody was ready to go back to buying stuff before they were ready to go back to work. And when you have demand greater than supply, economics tells us exactly what's going to happen. Prices are going to go up because you have to figure out how to allocate the limited supply. Think about what happened to cars. People wanted to buy cars. There weren't cars to buy. A lot of dealers decided that they would strip away the incentives, they would raise prices, and then there was also queuing. This is exactly what economics expects when demand outpaces supply. But there's another thing we expect. We expect everybody to be scrambling to try to find more to sell because prices are so high. And that's what we've seen, inflation coming down, not just in the US, but around the globe as supply has recovered. And as central banks have tried to reduce demand by having higher interest rates, inflation is below 4%. And I think the primary problem is not where inflation currently is, but that people are still adjusting to the new level of prices that we're at because of the higher inflation over the last 2 years. So you go to the grocery store and you're like, they want how much for hot dogs? And it's still a little bit of sticker shock. And prices don't ever really come back down. Like, once we've sort of inflated up, and they don't come back down because our wages also inflated up. So if we wanted to cut all those prices in the grocery store, we might also have to cut the wages of the workers. You ask yourself how likely you are to stick with your job if your boss comes in and says, to fight inflation, everybody's going to get a 5% cut in their wages so I can cut prices across the board 5%. Nobody's going to like that. And that's why prices don't come back down. But what we can hope for is that they stop increasing at a noticeable rate. But I think the challenge in this presidential election is that when prices are increasing 2% a year, most people don't notice. But it turns out that when they were increasing 9% and 6% and 3% and 4% a year, everybody's eyes are on the price increases. And so I think they're even going to be seeing 2% and being annoyed about that. And I think it's going to take several years for people to get past the shock of this inflationary period. And it'll probably shape how they see inflation for the rest of their lives in the same way that the 1970s inflation shaped how that generation saw inflation. So the bottom line is the economy is really strong right now. Inflation's pretty much under control, but how we feel about it, we're still processing those emotions.
Betsy Stevenson, wow, you're fantastic. I wish that you had been my economics professor, because I got to say, I knew exactly what was going to happen when demand went up and we didn't have the supply. That far I got, but I never really got the part about the people, and I wish I would have gotten it sooner. Thank you so much for doing this. I hope that you'll come back again. Where can our listeners find you and more of your work?
I'm on Twitter at Betsy Stevenson, and so they can find me there. And I'm a columnist for Bloomberg, so they can always look out for my columns.
Excellent. Thanks so much. Thank you so much for joining me today on Her Money. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our show at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a review. We love hearing what you think. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Edelman Financial Engines. Her Money is produced by Haley Pascalides. This show is mixed and mastered by CDM Sound Studios. Our music is provided by Video Helper, and our show comes to you through Megaphone. Check out our new podcast, How She Does It with Karen Feinerman, for intimate cocktail party style conversations with today's most talented female leaders. This podcast is also part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. You can find us and other shows like us at airwavemedia.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk soon.